Second Treatise of Government by John Locke, first published in 1689. This reading is based on the text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 8 and 9. Chapter 8, The Beginning of Political Societies. Men, all being naturally free, equal, and independent, no one can be deprived of this condition, and subjected to the political power of someone else without his own consent. The only way anyone can strip off his natural liberty, and clothe himself in the bonds of civil society, is for him to agree with other men to unite into a community, so as to live together comfortably, safely, and peaceably, in a secure enjoyment of their properties, and a greater security against outsiders. Any number of men can do this, because it does no harm to the freedom of the rest. They are left with the liberty of the state of nature, which they had all along. When any number of men have in this way consented to make one community or government, this immediately incorporates them, turns them into a single political body, in which the majority have a right to act on behalf of the rest, and to bind them by its decisions. A single body has to move in the way the greater force takes it, which is the consent of the majority. Otherwise it cannot continue to be one body, one community. So we see that in assemblies empowered to act by positive laws, where no number is set by the law that empowers them, the act of the majority counts as the act of the whole. Thus every man, by agreeing with others to make one body politic under one government, puts himself under an obligation to everyone in that society to submit to the decisions of the majority. If he were unwilling to submit to acts of the majority that he disapproved of, the original compact through which he and others incorporated into one society would be meaningless. It wouldn't be a compact if it left him as free of obligations as he had been in the state of nature. For if the consent of the majority isn't accepted as the act of the whole body politic, and as binding on every individual, the only basis there could be for something's counting as an act of the whole would be its having the consent of every individual. But it is virtually impossible for that ever to be had. Even with an assembly much smaller than that of an entire commonwealth, many will be kept from attending by ill health or by the demands of business. For that reason, and also because of the variety of opinions and conflicts of interests that inevitably occur in any collection of men, it would be absurd for them to come into society on such terms, that is, on the basis that the society as a whole does nothing that isn't assented to by each and every member of it. We can't think that this is what rational creatures would want in setting up political societies. So those who, out of a state of nature, unite into a community, must be understood to give up all the power needed for its purposes to the majority of the community. They achieve this simply by agreeing to unite into one political society. That's all the compact needed between the individuals who create or join a commonwealth. Thus, what begins a political society, and keeps it in existence, is nothing but the consent of any number of free men, capable of a majority to unite and incorporate into such a society. This is the only thing that did or could give a beginning to any lawful government in the world. The only possible exception to this would be an explicit agreement that any act of the society would require some number greater than the majority. Two objections have been made to this. First, history shows no examples, no cases, where a group of independent and equal men met together and in this way set up a government. Second, it can never be right for men to do this, because they are all bound to submit to the government they are born under, and aren't at liberty to begin a new one. I shall discuss these in turn. Here is an answer to the first objection. It is no wonder that history gives us very little account of men living together in the state of nature. As soon as any number of men were brought together by the inconveniences of that state, and by their love of society and their lack of it, they immediately united and incorporated if they planned to continue together. If we can conclude that men never were in the state of nature, because we don't hear much about them in such a state, we can just as well conclude that the soldiers of Xerxes were never children, because we hear little of them before the time when they became soldiers. In all parts of the world there was government before there were records. Writing seldom comes in among a people until a long stretch of civil society has, through other more necessary arts, such as agriculture and architecture, provided for their safety, ease, and affluence. When writing does eventually come in, people begin to look into the history of their founders, researching their origins when no memory remains of them. For commonwealths are like individual persons, in being, usually, ignorant of their own births and infancies. And when a commonwealth does know something about its origins, they owe that knowledge to the records that others happen to have kept of it. And such records as we have of the beginnings of political states give no support to paternal dominion, except for the Jewish state, where God himself stepped in. They are all either plain instances of the kind of beginning that I have described, or at least show clear signs of it. There are, in fact, several historical examples of free people in the state of nature, who met together, incorporated, and began a commonwealth. Rome and Venice, for instance, began by the uniting of men who were free and independent one of another, amongst whom there was no natural superiority or subjection. Who could deny this evident matter of fact? Only someone who is wedded to a hypothesis and won't accept anything that disagrees with it. I don't deny that if we look back as far as history will take us into the origins of commonwealths, we shall generally find them under the government and administration of one man. Also, I am inclined to believe the following. When a family was numerous enough to survive on its own, without mixing with others, the government commonly began in the father. By the law of nature he had the power to punish, as he thought fit, any offences against that law. This included punishing his offspring when they offended, even after they had become adults, and probably each submitted to his own punishment, and supported the father in punishing the others when they offended, thereby giving him power to carry out his sentence against any transgression. This would in effect make him the lawmaker and governor over everyone who continued to be connected with his family. He was the most fit to be trusted. Paternal affection secured their property and interest under his care, and the childhood custom of obeying him made it easier to submit to him than to anyone else. So if they had to have one man to rule them, who so likely to be that man as their common father, unless negligence, cruelty, or some other defect of mind or body made him unfit for it? But when the father died, and left as his next heir someone less fit to rule, because too young or lacking in wisdom, courage, or the like, or when several families met and agreed to continue together, it can't be doubted that then they used their natural freedom to set up as their ruler the one they judged to be the ablest and most likely to rule well. And so we find the people of America, ones who lived out of the reach of the conquering swords and spreading domination of the two great empires of Peru and Mexico, enjoyed their own natural freedom and made their own choices of ruler. Other things being equal, they have commonly preferred the heir of their deceased king, but when they find him to be weak or incapable, they pass him over and choose the toughest and bravest man as their ruler. So the prevalence in early times of government by one man doesn't destroy what I affirm, namely, that the beginning of political society depends upon the individuals consenting to create and be members of one society. And when they are thus incorporated, they can set up whatever form of government they think fit. But people have been misled by the historical records into thinking that, by nature, government is monarchical and belongs to the father. So perhaps we should consider here why people, in the beginning, generally chose this one-man form of government. The father's preeminence might explain this in the first stages of some commonwealths, but obviously the reason why government by a single person continued through the years was not a respect for paternal authority, since all small monarchies, and most are small in their early years, have at least sometimes been elective. In addition to the reasons I have just given for fathers to be accepted as rulers in the early years of a political society, there is a further fact. Monarchy would be simple and obvious to men whose experience hadn't instructed them in forms of government, and who hadn't encountered the ambition or insolence of empire, which might teach them to beware of the drawbacks of absolute power, which a hereditary monarchy was apt to lay claim to. So it wasn't at all strange if they didn't take the trouble to think much about methods of restraining any excesses on the part of those to whom they had given authority over them, and of balancing the power of government by placing different parts of it in different hands. It is no wonder they gave themselves a form of government that was not only obvious and simple, but also best suited to their present state and condition, in which they needed defence against foreign invasions and injuries more than they needed a multiplicity of laws. And thus we see that the kings of the Indians in America are little more than generals of their armies. They command absolutely in war, where there can't be a plurality of governors, so that command is exercised on the king's sole authority. But at home and in times of peace, they exercise very little power, and have only a very moderate kind of sovereignty, the resolutions of peace and war being ordinarily made either by the people as a whole or by a council. It is important to keep America in mind, because America, even now, is similar to how Asia and Europe were in the early years, when there was more land than the people could use, and the lack of people and of money left men with no temptation to enlarge their possessions of land. Similarly, in Israel, the chief business of their judges and first kings seems to have been to be leaders of their armies. So a commonwealth might begin in either of two ways. In one, a family gradually grew up into a commonwealth, and the fatherly authority was passed on in each generation in the way I have described. In the other, several families came to be settled in proximity to one another, and formed a social bond. They needed a general whose conduct might defend them against their enemies in war, so they made one man their ruler, with no explicit limitation or restraint except what was implied by the purposes of government. This lack of precautions reflected the great mutual confidence of the men who first started commonwealths, a product of the innocence and sincerity of that poor but virtuous age. Whichever of those it was that first put the rule into the hands of a single person, it is certain that when someone was entrusted with the status of ruler, this was for the public good and safety, and that in the infancies of commonwealths, those who had that status ordinarily used it for those ends. If they hadn't, young societies could not have survived. That was in the golden age, before vain ambition and wicked greed had corrupted men's minds into misunderstanding the nature of true power and honour. That age had more virtue, and consequently better governors and less vicious subjects, than we do now. So there was, on one side, no stretching of powers to oppress the people, and consequently, on the other side, no disputatious attempts to lessen or restrict the power of the government, and therefore no contest between rulers and people about governors or government. In later ages, however, ambition and luxury led monarchs to retain and increase their power without doing the work they were given it to do, and led them also, with the help of flattery, to have distinct and separate interests from their people. So men found it necessary to examine more carefully the origin and rights of government, and to discover ways to restrain the excesses, and prevent the abuses of the power they had put into someone's hands, only for their own good, finding that, in fact, it was being used to hurt them. The other objection that has been brought against my account of how political societies begin is this. All men are born under some government or other, so it is impossible for anyone to be at liberty to unite with others to begin a new government. Impossible, anyway, to do this lawfully. If this argument is sound, how did there come to be so many lawful monarchies in the world. To someone who accepts the argument, I say, show me any one man in any age of the world who was free to begin a lawful monarchy, and I'll show you 10 other free men who were at liberty at that time to unite and begin a new government of some form or other. For it can be demonstrated that if someone born under the dominion of someone else can be free enough to come to have a right to command others in a new and distinct empire, everyone born under the dominion of someone else can have that same freedom to become a ruler or subject of a distinct separate government. And so, according to this line of thought, either all men are free, whatever government they were born under, or there is only one lawful monarch, one lawful government in the world. In the latter case, my opponents have only to point him out, and when they have done that, I am sure all mankind will easily agree to obey him. This is a sufficient answer to their objection, but I shall try to reveal its weakness a little further. They say, all men are born under some government, and therefore can't be at liberty to begin a new one. Everyone is born a subject to his father or his king, and is therefore perpetually a subject who owes allegiance to someone. Obviously, mankind has never admitted or believed that any natural subjection that they were born into, without their own consent, whether to father or to king, made them subjects for the rest of their lives, and did the same to their heirs. For history is full of examples of men removing themselves and their obedience from the jurisdiction they were born under, and from the family or community they grew up in, and setting up new governments in other places. This has been the practice of the world from its first beginning to the present day. Men who are now born under constituted and long-standing political states, with established laws and set forms of government, are no more restricted in their freedom by that fact about their birth than they would be if they had been born in the forests, among the ungoverned inhabitants who run loose there. Those who want to persuade us that by being born under a government we are naturally subject to it have only one argument for their position, apart from the argument from paternal power, which I have already answered, namely, our fathers or ancestors gave up their natural liberty and thereby bound up themselves and their posterity to perpetual subjection to the government to which they themselves submitted. But no one can, by any compact whatever, bind his children or posterity, for when his son becomes an adult, he is altogether as free as the father. So an act of the father can no more give away the liberty of the son than it can give away anyone else's liberty. A father can indeed attach conditions to the inheritance of his land, so that the son can't own and enjoy his father's former possessions unless he becomes or continues to be a subject of the commonwealth to which the father used to belong. Because that estate is the father's property, he can dispose of it in any way he likes. This has led to a widespread mistake concerning political subjection. Commonwealths don't permit any part of their land to be dismembered or to be enjoyed by any but their own members. So a son can't ordinarily enjoy the possessions, mainly consisting of land, of his father, except on the terms on which his father did, namely, becoming by his own consent a member of that society. And that immediately subjects him to the government he finds established there, just as much as any other subject of that commonwealth. So free men, born under the government, do give their consent to it, doing this through the inheritance of land. I have shown that every man is naturally free, and that nothing can make him subject to any earthly power except his own consent. That raises the question, what are we to understand as a sufficient declaration of a man's consent? Sufficient, that is, to make him subject to the laws of some government. The common distinction between explicit and tacit consent is relevant here. Nobody doubts that an explicit consent of a man entering into a society makes him perfectly a member of that society, a subject of that government? What counts as tacit consent, and how far does it bind? That is, what does a man have to do to be taken to have consented to be subject of a given government, when he hasn't explicitly given such consent? I answer, if a man owns or enjoys some part of the land under a given government, while that enjoyment lasts, he gives his tacit consent to the laws of that government, and is obliged to obey them. This holds whether the land is the owned property of himself and his heirs for ever, or he only lodges on it for a week. It holds, indeed, if he is only travelling freely on the highway, and in effect it holds as long as he is merely in the territories of the government in question. To understand this better, consider how land comes within the reach of governments. The act through which a person unites himself, his previously free self, to any commonwealth, also unites his possessions, his previously free possessions, to that commonwealth. Both of them, the person and his possessions, are subject to the government and dominion of that commonwealth for as long as it exists. From that time on, therefore, anyone who comes to enjoy that land, whether through inheritance, purchase, permission, or whatever, must take it with the condition it is already under, namely, submission to the government of the commonwealth under whose jurisdiction it falls. So much for land. Now, for the users of land. If a landowner hasn't actually incorporated himself in the society of the commonwealth, whose domain includes the land in question, the government of that commonwealth has direct jurisdiction only over the land. Its jurisdiction reaches as far as the landowner only when and to the extent that he lives on his land and enjoys it. The political obligation that someone is under, by virtue of his enjoyment of his land, begins and ends with the enjoyment. So if a landowner, who has given only this sort of tacit consent to the government, wants to donate, sell, or otherwise get rid of his land, he is at liberty to go and incorporate himself into some other commonwealth, or to agree with others to begin a new one in any part of the world that they can find free and unpossessed. In contrast, if someone has once by actual agreement, and an explicit declaration, given his consent to belonging to some commonwealth, he is perpetually and irrevocably obliged to continue as its subject. He can never be again in the liberty of the state of nature, unless, through some calamity, the government in question comes to be dissolved, or by some public act stops him from continuing to be a member of that commonwealth. But submitting to the laws of a country, living quietly and enjoying privileges and protection under them, doesn't make a man a member of that society. All it does is to give him local protection from, and oblige him to pay local homage to the government of that country. This doesn't make him a member of that society, a perpetual subject of that commonwealth, any more than you would become subject to me because you found it convenient to live for a time in my household, though while you are there you would be obliged to comply with the laws and submit to the government that you found there. And so we see that foreigners, who live all their lives under another government, enjoying the privileges and protection of it, don't automatically come to be subjects or members of that commonwealth, though they are bound by positive law and even in conscience to submit to its administration, just as its subjects or members are. Nothing can make a man a subject, except his actually entering into the commonwealth by positive engagement and explicit promise and compact. That is what I think regarding the beginning of political societies, and the consent that makes one a member of a commonwealth. Chapter 9. The Purposes of Political Society and Government. The great and chief purpose of men's uniting into commonwealths and putting themselves under government is the preservation of their lives, liberties, and estates, which I call by the general name property. The state of nature lacks many things needed for this. I shall discuss three of them. First, the state of nature lacks an established, settled, known law, received and accepted by common consent as the standard of right and wrong, and as the common measure to decide all controversies. What about the law of nature? Well, it is plain and intelligible to all reasonable creatures, but men are biased by self-interest, as well as ignorant about the law of nature, because they don't study it, so they aren't apt to accept it as a law that will bind them if it is applied to their particular cases. Second, the state of nature lacks a known and impartial judge, with authority to settle all differences according to the established law. In that state, everyone is both judge and enforcer of the law of nature, and few men will play either role well. Men are partial to themselves, so that passion and revenge are very apt to carry them too far, and with too much heat in their own cases, and their negligence and lack of concern will make them remiss in other men's cases. Third, the state of nature often lacks a power to support a correct sentence and to enforce it properly. People who have committed crimes will usually, if they can, resort to force to retain the benefits of their crime. This includes using force to resist punishment, and such resistance often makes the punishment dangerous, even destructive, to those who try to inflict it. Thus, mankind are in poor shape while they remain in the state of nature, despite all their privileges there, so that they are quickly driven into society. That is why we seldom find any number of men living together for long in this state. The drawbacks it exposes them to make them take refuge under the established laws of government and seek there to preserve their property. This is what makes each of them so willing to give up his power of punishing, a power then to be exercised only by whoever is appointed to that role, this being done by rules agreed on by the community, or by those whom they have authorized to draw up the rules for them. This is the basic cause and justification for the legislative and executive powers within a government, as well as for the governments and societies themselves. For in the state of nature a man has, along with his liberty to enjoy innocent delights, two powers. The first is to do whatever he thinks fit for the preservation of himself and of others, so far as the law of nature permits. This law makes him and all the rest of mankind into one community, one society, distinct from all other creatures. And if it weren't for the corruption and viciousness of degenerate men, there would be no need for any other law, no need for men to separate from this great natural community, and by positive agreements combine into separate smaller associations. The other power a man has in the state of nature is the power to punish crimes committed against the law of nature. When a man joins in any society, any commonwealth, separate from the rest of mankind, he gives up the first power, letting it be regulated by laws made by the society, so far as is required for the preservation of himself and the rest of the society. Such laws greatly restrict the liberty he had under the law of nature, and he wholly gives up the power of punishing. The natural force that he could use for punishment in the state of nature, he now puts at the disposal of the executive power of the society. Now that he is in a new state, in which he will enjoy many advantages from the labour, assistance, and society of others in the same community, as well as protection from the strength of the community as a whole, he must also give up something. For he will have to part with as much of his natural freedom to provide for himself as is required for the welfare, prosperity, and safety of the society. As well as being necessary, this is fair, because the other members of the society are doing the same thing. But though men who enter into society give up the equality, liberty, and executive power they had in the state of nature, each of them does this only with the intention of better preserving himself, his liberty, and his property, for no rational creature can be thought to change his condition intending to make it worse. So the power of the society or legislature that they create can never be supposed to extend further than the common good. It is obliged to secure everyone's property by providing against the three defects mentioned earlier in Chapter 9, the ones that made the state of nature so unsafe and uneasy. Whoever has the legislative or supreme power in any commonwealth, therefore, is bound to govern not by on-the-spot decrees, but by established standing laws, promulgated and known to the people, with unbiased and upright judges, appointed to apply those laws in deciding controversies, and to employ the force of the community at home only in the enforcement of such laws, or abroad to prevent or correct foreign injuries and secure the community from attack. And all this is to be directed to the peace, safety, and public good of the people, and to nothing else. End of chapters 8 and 9.